Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking about two books about the post-Katrina recovery. Daniel Wolfe is the author of The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. And Tom Wooten has written We Shall Not Be Moved, Rebuilding Home in the Wake of Katrina. We'll also have a word about the books celebrating Julia Child's 100th birthday. Daniel Wolfe is the author of a new book, The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. It is the story of a number of New Orleanians' slow post-Katrina struggle to regain their lives and spirits and houses after the floods devastated our city in 2005. He is also the producer of a film series with Jonathan Demme called Right to Return, or Home Movies from the Lower Ninth Ward. The next film in the series, I Am Carolyn Parker, premieres in September on Point of View on public television. Daniel, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
How did you first get involved with this New Orleans project?
Well, Jonathan Demme and I are friends, and after the floods happened, we looked at each other and said, what are we going to do? This is a paramount national issue. And being slightly dim-witted, it took us a while to figure out that what we should do is come down there and look around. So about 5 months after the floods, we came down. He had a handheld camera. I had a notebook. We thought we might make one visit or two. We ended up coming back over 6 years, about every 2 or 3 months, to document the lives of these people trying to recover.
And when was the last time you were here?
Oh, my goodness. We were last down here in, I think, last November, finishing up I'm Carolyn Parker.
Oh, wow. So tell us about some of the New Orleanians who captured your attention in this series and this book.
Well, we did this, Susan, very haphazardly. It was sort of who we ran into. And when we arrived, people kept saying, you think it's bad here, keep going. And we went farther and farther into the city, and we ran into a bunch of different people. The block that Carolyn Parker lives on in Holy Cross is an integrated block, was absolutely devastated, was empty, was a ghost town when we got there. And we got to know her and her family, her neighbors, Patsy and Mark and Lathan. And that's sort of one of the narratives that runs through my book. And obviously her story is the focus of I'm Carolyn Parker. Mm-hmm. We also ran into Pastor Mel, who was a born-again minister, ex-addict, who ran a homeless shelter for ex-addicts. And his story was both trying to keep his men okay, trying to get back into his own home, and trying to get his 75-year-old parents back into their home. And finally, we took a look at Common Ground, the volunteer organization, and what was happening and what everybody talked of as Backatown, which was that part of the Lower Ninth where the levee had actually broken, where Brad Pitt ended up making the houses. So those three narratives go in and out of the book and occasionally interconnect.
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide to write a book as well as make a film? I'm curious to know, because you've written so many books. You've written a biography of Sam Cooke. You wrote that wonderful book, How Lincoln Learned to Read. You've written about lots of different things. So how do you mix that kind of film and literary effort?
Well, in this case, movies are slow. Not to watch them, but to make them. And we got Carolyn Parker done, 6 years after we started coming down. And I thought, there are a bunch of stories that we may or may not get to on film that I feel obligated to the people and to the city to tell. And, you've read the book. It's more their voice than mine. I'm trying to get the voices of people who live through this. They're the experts. So I felt that need. And I also, the longer I did it, the more I got the reverse of Katrina fatigue, the more interested I got about it. Now, I think it's what happens to New Orleans is key to what happens to this country in this century. And I think the issues it faces are the issues most American cities are facing, perhaps more slowly because they weren't flooded, but they're exactly the same thing. So that when Detroit or Chicago or Oakland talks about recovery and rebuilding, I think you'll hit the same issues that New Orleans is facing right now.
And also resilience, the idea of what does it take to come back from this kind of thing.
You have a city of extraordinary people.
They're great storytellers, aren't they?
Well, they're not only storytellers, but resilience. It's just amazing to me. You know, they wouldn't take no for an answer, and there were a lot of no's given to them about how they couldn't move back. You know, they didn't have health care. They didn't have adequate police protection. In a lot of cases, their churches were closed down. I mean, there was no place to turn, yet folks said, well, no, this is home. I'm going to be here. And plunked themselves down and made it work. It's admirable.
Well, I know that in one interview, Jonathan Demme said he's not sure the people of Rockland County would fight to come back if there were a disaster.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a question of whether New Orleans is special. But as I said, I think the fight for home, the fight for people who are losing their homes through various means across the country, mm-hmm. is a real one. And I think people do feel strongly that, you know, this is where I grew up, or this is where I had my kids, or whatever it is.
It's a great title because it has been a fight. And, you know, everybody who lives here knows it, you know. One of the things I'm curious to ask you is, when these films are shown, what is the difference, if can you tell a difference, between the people in New Orleans watching them and the people in other parts of the country watching them? What kind of, you know, reaction do you get?
The times we've shown it in New Orleans so far, the people tend to talk back to the screen. They tend to go, oh, yeah, I know that person, or that's right, that happened to me too. There's a lot more kind of, it's like home movies a little bit, right? That's why we call the first movie new home movies in the lower Ninth Ward.
Mm-hmm.
In the rest of the country, there's incredible admiration for what New Orleans has gone through, and a little bit of, I think, shock and disbelief, because the story was supposedly the floods and the immediate lack of help. And I think people may have lost track of what's going on. And so when they see these movies, or I hope read this book, they kind of go, oh, yeah, it's still there. It's still an issue.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to ask you, too, what did it do for you personally to spend so much time on this project and so much time in this place?
Well, I love it. You know, it's weird, Susan, because I've been down there a lot, and people then ask me, so, oh, I'm going to New Orleans. What should I do there? And I realize I'm the worst tourist guide in the world, because what I know is these neighborhoods, the part of New Orleans that tourists don't see. So, you know, I can't tell them the good restaurants. I can't tell them what to do on Bourbon Street. That isn't the New Orleans I saw. I saw a city of homes, whether they were rental apartments or houses, and people fighting to get back to them. And it was inspirational to me, frankly. I mean, like I said, I think it's indicative of where the country's going, and the issues that really face us are all right there in New Orleans.
And I have to ask you one last question, because this is The Reading Life. You're the author of a terrific book, How Lincoln Learned to Read. I love that book, and I wish you'd talk just a little bit about that for us.
Sure. How Lincoln Learned to Read looks at a dozen Americans, starting with Ben Franklin, before the country was formed, and ending with Elvis Presley, because he's the end of things, and looking at people from W.E.B. Du Bois to Andrew Jackson, a whole variety of folks, and seeing how they learned what they thought was important, whether it was reading or using their hands. Henry Ford learned almost everything, as far as I can tell, by taking apart machinery. And the book came about because I had an ongoing struggle with public education, not that different from the sort of issues New Orleans is facing, which is, what's the point of this? Is it serving everybody? Are our kids gaining or losing through all of this? And so I wanted to look at Americans we all admire and see how they learned the stuff they thought was important to them. And, you know, I applied that book some to the fight for home, only because one of the issues that runs through that book is about education in New Orleans and the decisions that have been made and how kids have come through it.
There's so many different kinds of education in that book. I mean, there's that wonderful line you have about Henry Ford, you know, if machines were Henry's books, then this was a library. You know, stuff like that. So tell us how Lincoln did learn to read, would you?
Sure. Although that's bad for book sales. I mean, you know, it's supposed to be a cliffhanger.
No, the Elvis will keep them coming.
There you go. You know, Lincoln learned to read as many, many people did and do still, I think, at his mother's knee. And in this case, also at his stepmother's knee. But he was taught at home. And the thing that was fascinating for me was that Lincoln didn't just want to read. He wanted to understand. And what would infuriate him was when there was an adult conversation and he'd try to get it, and they'd say, no, you're too young. You can't explain it to him. He would go off and study it, and he would later study books that way. until he could figure it out. And the way he knew he had figured it out was if he could explain it to another kid in his own words. And so the sort of triumphant end of Lincoln learning how to read was not just comprehending the words, but being able to actually understand the ideas by explaining them to someone else.
Well, I loved that. I loved that book so much. And I can't tell you, as kind of, you know, someone who spends her whole life reading about New Orleans, it is so thrilling to read books about the comeback rather than all the other terrible things. This was a very inspiring book for me, and I think it will be for many people.
Oh, well, thanks very much.
Daniel Wolfe will be discussing and signing The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back, Thursday, August 16th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. He'll be screening the film I Am Carolyn Parker, August 17th at Ashe Cultural Arts Center at 6:30 p.m. and appearing at Community Book Center on August 18th. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks very much. It's my pleasure.
Tom Wooten is a formidable young man. Raised in a Boston suburb, he's made the Crescent City his adopted home, moving here after graduating from Harvard in 2008. He's the co-author, with his Harvard roommate Utpal Sundaresara, of No One Had a Tongue to Speak, the story of a catastrophic dam collapse in India. It was published last year. Tom has been named one of Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30, and he's here today to talk about his second book, We Shall Not Be Moved, Rebuilding Home in the Wake of Katrina. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Susan. How's it going?
Great. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've accomplished a lot in a short time.
Well, thank you so much. Living in New Orleans makes all of the work that I've done incredibly easy because it's such a wonderful place to be.
Tell us about the first time you came to New Orleans.
I first arrived in New Orleans in February of 2007. I was chaperoning a volunteer group of high school students who had come down to volunteer on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I'll never forget coming off of the Twin Span into New Orleans East and just getting a sense of the tremendous scale of the devastation. We had already been driving for an hour, and we could have driven another hour and still been surrounded by complete destruction. I saw this tremendously large city that seemed to be almost lifeless, and I wanted to understand what it was going to take to bring life back.
And so you stayed for a while and worked, and then you went back and finished up at Harvard.
Yes, my first extended time in the city was during the summer of 2007 when I came down to work in the Broadmoor neighborhood and when I was doing research also in Gentilly and Lakeview. I was writing my senior thesis at the time about the work that neighborhood organizations were doing in the city. The Kennedy School was tremendously interested in the role of neighborhoods in the recovery because neighborhoods had essentially come to fill in for government. The city government, the state government, and the federal government, each in their own way, had really fallen down on the job. And so residents in different neighborhoods across New Orleans were filling in. For example, in Broadmoor, at the time, residents were hard at work opening a charter school. They were working very hard to reopen their library using a $2 million grant from the Carnegie Endowment. There were plans in the works, which have since come to fruition, to implement a neighborhood-wide tax just to fund neighborhood projects. There were social services that were coming online just for Broadmoor residents. All of these are things that we think government should be doing. And instead, it was an organized group of residents making that happen within the borders of their neighborhood. And we were seeing that same thing happen in other neighborhoods across the city, and we were tremendously interested in that phenomenon.
And you found some very charismatic individuals in the Broadmoor neighborhood, didn't you?
Yes, we were welcomed into Broadmoor by Latoya Cantrell, who is the president of the Broadmoor Improvement Association, and she is a force of nature.
Yes.
She was somebody who immediately made us all feel welcome and like we were part of a big extended family. And her personality was forceful enough that people really came to believe the vision that she had that the neighborhood could return. She was not the only leader in Broadmoor. There was also Father Jerry, who is the pastor of the Episcopal Church in Broadmoor. He decided after the storm that the only way that his church would be viable and could come back was if the neighborhood it was in came back too, and devoted his church wholly to bringing the neighborhood back. They bought up the block around the church, mm-hmm. went more than $1 million in debt, and then opened a 125-bed volunteer center, and also gave the neighborhood association a free office space. So they really put themselves on the line for the neighborhood, knowing that that was the only way that they could come back and survive themselves.
And you debuted this book at a really important landmark in Broadmoor just recently. Tell us about that evening.
Yes, we had a book launch at the Rosa F. Keller Library and Community Center, which is a beautiful, newly opened space just at the top of Napoleon Avenue. There's not only a community library there, but there's also a coffee shop called the Green Dot Cafe, which is named in honor of, or perhaps in spite of, the green dot that the Bring New Orleans Back Commission placed over Broadmoor, suggesting that it might not return. It has a beautiful conference space, and it has a wonderful kitchen where our caterers prepared a dinner. So we had music, we had food, and lots of dear friends who came from all of the five neighborhoods that I wrote about to be at the debut of this book.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the other neighborhoods, because New Orleans is a city of neighborhoods, and you have made a really conscious effort to include a broad spectrum of neighborhoods.
Yes, the five neighborhoods in the book are Broadmoor, Holly Grove, Lakeview, the Vietnamese community in New Orleans East, and the Lower Ninth Ward. And each neighborhood has its own unique story, and in a way, each one is a character in the book. I think they represent a broad cross-section of experiences. They certainly represent a broad cross-section of the challenges that people faced after the storm. And each one recovered in its own way, and all of the stories, I think, are instructive and inspiring.
Tell us about some of the individuals who have been key to these neighborhoods.
Yes. Well, one person who I met very early on is a man named Terry Miranda, who lives in Lakeview. And Terry, like me, goes everywhere by bike. And he is an amateur historian of the city and somebody who really likes to tell you stories about wherever you are in the city. So he gave me several bike tours, not only of Lakeview, but of other places across the city, and really helped me come to understand the city's character.
And you profile Holly Grove and some really innovative things that happened there after the storm as well.
Yes, of course. So in Holly Grove, much like in Broadmoor, there is a religious organization, Trinity Christian Community, that had done a great deal of work before the storm, and that work was jeopardized by the fact that people hadn't returned. So Kevin Brown, who is the director of Trinity Christian Community, decided that he needed to turn his youth-focused organization into a recovery-focused organization until the kids came back. And so he turned his space into a volunteer center and brought in 125 AmeriCorps workers to work not only in Holly Grove, but also across the city. One of the people he introduced me to, who's another real New Orleans character, is a man named Phil Harris, who is at the time 78 years old, and when I met with him, well over 80. Phil came back to his house very soon after the storm in a very determined way. He would hitchhike to his house every day from uptown, where his family had a small flat, and work slowly on his home. He had experience as a builder and contractor himself, and had many friends who were contractors. And so slowly but surely brought his own house back with a dedication that I found really inspiring.
And then, too, you touch on the Vietnamese community, which has been such a model of inspiration and coming back.
Yes, of course. The Vietnamese community was incredibly organized before the storm. That organization dates back to their roots in North Vietnam in the 1950s when they first had to be refugees from the rise of Ho Chi Minh. They were refugees again with the fall of Saigon when the North took over the South. And a number of them ended up in eastern New Orleans where Archbishop Hannon had put them in Section 8 housing out there. So they built their community around the Catholic Church, around Mary Queen of Vietnam Catholic Church. And that organization went well back to when they were in North Vietnam. North Vietnamese Catholic villages are always based around a Catholic church, with the priest at the head and with residents filling in underneath the priest in different councils that govern the neighborhood. So Father Vien was the priest at the time, and he's another dynamic character who is featured prominently in the book.
They are a remarkable example of the city's resilience to me. It's one of my favorite parts of the city anyway. But last but not least, you tell the story of Pam Daschle.
Pam Daschle was a really special person. She was a leader in Holy Cross in the Lower Ninth Ward. She had been a neighborhood activist there since the late 1980s and was a singularly remarkable person, as everybody who knew her would attest. Her work began with organizing against the industrial canal expansion, which would have demolished dozens or hundreds of homes in the Lower Ninth Ward. And her work continued after the storm. She was an advocate for the Lower Ninth, an advocate for people being able to return, and also a visionary who saw the potential not only for Holy Cross and the Lower Ninth Ward to be rebuilt, but to be rebuilt in a more resilient and more environmentally sustainable way.
And you see her as one of the martyrs of the recovery, don't you?
Pam, unfortunately, worked herself to death. She is somebody who cared so deeply about her neighbors and her neighborhood and her city that she would work around the clock and didn't take care of herself in the way that many of the people who loved her wished that she would. And in fact, she died at her computer doing work on behalf of her neighborhood.
I know, such a story. And in the process of all this, of writing this book, doing this work, you've decided to make New Orleans your home.
New Orleans is a singularly wonderful place, and I couldn't imagine living anywhere else.
Good. Well, stick around. You've already been participating in rebuilding, educational reform. Keep it up.
Thank you so much, Susan.
We've been talking with Tom Wooten, whose wonderful new book is We Shall Not Be Moved, Rebuilding Home in the Wake of Katrina. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Susan.
August 15th is Julia Child's 100th birthday. Here's a literary toast to that prolific author in three charming new books. Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child by best-selling Beatles biographer Bob Spitz is a delight from start to finish. He had the pleasure of traveling with Julia in Sicily in 1992, and his enthusiasm for her shows on every one of these 534 pages. He begins with a memorable scene, Julia's first appearance on public television in Boston on a program called, wonderfully enough, People Are Reading. She came along with a hot plate and an omelet pan, the ubiquitous butter, and fresh eggs, all to make the perfect omelet. Here's how Pitts describes the moment. In a sudden sweeping motion, Julia grabbed the pan's long handle and began jerking it back and forth, as if some unseen force was trying to wrench it from her grip. The energy behind it convulsed her body in sharp spastic tremors. This vision of Julia Child, gyrating like a wind-up toy, would be an enduring, endearing image for millions of viewers for the next 40 years. But that night, without warning, it set off alarms. In the wings, Miffy Goodhart, who worked on the show, held her breath, watching the unfolding action in horror. Julia's loose white shirt was open at the collar, she recalls, and as she made the omelet, her rather large boobs were going furiously, and going, and going. The energy with which she made this omelet while talking about her book, and staring into the camera, and laughing madly, and talking to Albert on the side, and whisking everything right up, and turning it over, and looking triumphant all at once, I was absolutely sure those buttons were coming undone. And what then? What then, exactly? It was a function of live TV that nothing was foreordained. There were no contingencies in place for the unscripted faux pas or sudden expletive or the unforeseen appearance of a locomotive breast. One did as Miffy Goodhart did. She held her breath and prayed. For just a moment through the blinding skein of lights, Miffy glimpsed the entire future of WGBH, resting on the breasts of Julia Child. In retrospect, perhaps there was no better place. And so it began, Julia's career in television. But so much came before that. A privileged childhood in California, a posting in the OSS during World War II, a marriage to her beloved Paul Child, later postings in Paris, where she discovered her passion for food, and Norway and Germany, and then onward to conquering America with cookbooks and television shows and incredible fame. Spitz takes us step by step through this remarkable life, demonstrating how Julia changed the world. She changed American cooking, changed the publication of cookbooks, was in at the beginning of food television, and was one of the very first celebrity chefs, even though she refused that title for herself because she'd never cooked in a restaurant. She opened women's eyes to what was possible in life. She was a woman of her time and a woman for all time. There are also two sweet new books out this year for young readers. Minette's Feast, The Delicious Story of Julia Child and Her Cat, by Suzanne Reich and illustrated by Amy Bates, is a lovely story of Julia's time in Paris, told from the vantage point of her cat, Minette. Minette watches her mistress cook and cook, but prefers a freshly caught mouse for dinner, until one day Julia makes a dish that is simply too delicious to refuse. This is a charming story, and the illustrations evoke a Parisian kitchen in all its charm. Be sure to look for the mice hiding on several pages. Bon Appetit, The Delicious Life of Julia Child by Jesse Hartland is truly a confection to savor. Done in that trademark blue of mastering the art of French cooking, this story celebrates Julia's life. The pages are crowded with details of her history, French phrases and scenes, all accompanied by fanciful illustrations. This is the perfect book for the child in all of us. Reading these books, thinking back over her life, it occurs to me what an inspiration Julia Child remains, for me and for most of the women I know. And the remarkable thing about her is that she offers some bit of wisdom or consolation for every stage in a woman's life. Are you a young girl who seems to have no special talent, who feels too tall? Look at Julia and how she turned out. Are you a young woman searching for your passion? Look at Julia. Passion eventually comes, even if you must work at it. Want to shake things up? Look at Julia. Always game, always fearless. Are you sure that you'll never be perfect? There's Julia, blithely tossing things over her shoulder. Don't apologize for your mistakes. It is what it is, she'd say. Serve it up. Bon appetit. These are good lessons for all of us to learn. A true recipe for the good life. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Maple Street Bookshop Healing Center location is starting a book club. They'll be meeting for the first time Tuesday, August 14th at 7 p.m. in Fatouche, downstairs from the bookshop at the Healing Center. This month's book is Marcus Samuelson's memoir, Yes, Chef. Ke'ini Yabura Salam, author of Ancient, Ancient, discusses her work with Moira Crone, author of The Not Yet. Wednesday, August 15th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. And again, Friday, August 17th at 6 at Community Book Center. Today's guest, Daniel Wolfe, signs The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back, Thursday, August 16th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Retired basketball player James Dukes Donaldson of the Seattle Supersonics, San Diego LA Clippers, Dallas Mavericks, New York Knicks, Utah Jazz, Harlem Globetrotters, and NBA All-Star of 1988 will read from and sign Standing Above the Crowd, Execute Your Game Plan to Be the Best You Can Be, Saturday, August 18th at 1 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Maple Street Bookshop will celebrate Julia Child's 100th birthday with a reading of Jesse Hartland's Bon Appetit, The Delicious Life of Julia Child, Saturday, August 18th at 11:30 a.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Physical trainer Jennifer Lorman signs her book, Mommy Movement, New Baby, New Body, New Life, Sunday, August 19th at 2 p.m. at Octavia Books. Illustrator Peter Brown signs his children's book, Creepy Carrots, August 22nd at 4 p.m. at Octavia Books. And are you a poet who wants to get your work more widely known? You have until September 1st to submit your work to the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival Poetry Contest. The judge is Ava Lavelle Heyman, and the grand prize is $1,000. For guidelines and submission, check out tennesseewilliams.net/contests. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.